Well, thanks, John. So I wanted to just start by saying that I actually have a hearing problem. I can't hear out of my right ear, so I can't tell how loudly I'm speaking. So if you're having trouble one way or another, please let me know. What I'm going to emphasize today is actually symbolic politics. One can argue that this is not a system created to fail, it's actually a system created to succeed, but it depends on whom we're talking about succeeding for. So, first of all, I wanted to just thank my colleague, Rebecca Hasso-Aguilar, with whom I've worked on these issues for some years now, and who finished her doctoral dissertation at the University of New Mexico on anti-privatization struggles in Latin America. My daughter, Sofia Borges, who's helped with a number of the graphics and organization of the presentation. Ollie Fine, Steffi Woolhandler, and David Himmelstein of PNHP. And also, believe it or not, a little bit of financial support from the RWJ Foundation Center for Health Policy at UNM. Now, I actually spell these ideas out, at least some of them, in a little bit more depth in a book that came out a couple of years ago. And the overall points of the book, which I'm not going to go into today in depth, basically stresses an optimism, which is that capitalism as we've known it actually has come to an end. And we're now dealing with something else. Also, empire as we've known it has ended. This current period is a very important conjuncture of history in which fundamental change involving year after year the slow collapse of the global capitalist system is actually scary to all of us, but also exhilarating. And we all need to choose how we can contribute to our alternative future. And these years are the time to do it. So, this is a familiar history, I hope, to you. A dynamic, young, newly elected president makes health reform one of his highest priorities. His proposal aims to improve access for the uninsured and underinsured. To achieve that goal, he decides to collaborate with the private for-profit insurance industry. Public hospitals and other public sector institutions would compete with the private insurance sector for public tax-generated revenues. So this is the person we're talking about. It's Cesar Gaviria, and I'll tell you in a moment who he is, but I just wanted to point out the background of the World Economic Forum here, where he presented this reform. Gaviria was president of Colombia between 1990 and 1994. And the health reform that he and his group initiated was Law 100. It was passed in 1994. The path-breaking, as it's been called, health reform of Colombia, which I'm going to hopefully show you, is actually the model for Obamacare. This was actually supported by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, and the World Economic Forum, that is the leading financial elites of our global economy. It's been a model for health reform that's been promoted by the World Bank, actually worldwide, and now has come home to roost in the United States in the version of the ACA. Now, this is what might remind you of the ACA. This is actually the Colombia health reform of 1994. And, you know, these are some of the terms that are applied. This was described several years ago in Health Affairs: stewardship, financing, insurance management, and delivery systems, dealing with the uninsured, the subsidized regime, and the contributory regime. Now, what I've tried to do in the next slide is to superimpose Obamacare onto the Colombian health reform. And interestingly, it's very similar. These are what in Colombia what are called global budget case-based reimbursement and basically the funding groups in the society, which correspond to our exchanges. And then these are the delivery groups, which correspond to accountable care organizations or one of the other organizational forms of delivery, of the delivery structure. The financing includes co-payments, contributions to a mandatory Social Security system, and I want to just emphasize that, and I'll come back to it, that is the importance of public sector trust funds as the basis for these so-called reforms, and also the tax structure. So, neoliberalism. Since the early 1980s, this has been the dominant political economic ideology that's been promoted worldwide. Neoliberalism argues that market exchange maximizes the social good, and this was part of the so-called Washington Consensus in the early 1980s, that human well-being could advance best by enhancing individual entrepreneurial activities in the framework of strong property rights, a free market, and free trade, that economic growth is beneficial for everyone, at least in the long term. And this has been promoted again by the same international financial institutions. However, in addition to economic change, neoliberalism also became a social, political, and cultural project. It favored the role of the state as protecting market practices, also opposed the state's role in central planning and in the provision of public services, including medicine and public health, and it favored privatization of public services, very important. And this is the point I want to emphasize, with the use of public tax revenues for private for-profit insurance corporations. It favored drastic cutbacks in public sector services and expenditures, so-called structural adjustment. And also free market principles displaced those of classical economic liberals who, as John said, favored a relatively but not completely unregulated market such as Adam Smith and David Ricardo, hence the term neoliberal. So it's not liberal, but even more so, with even less market restriction and regulation. The term structural adjustment recently has been somewhat replaced by austerity as the terminology, but it's basically referring to the same set of policies. Now, in terms of evaluations, the evaluations done by these organizations have been overall positive. And so the Colombia reform has actually been a model for the World Bank proposals in Mexico, Brazil, Chile, and many other countries. When one works in Latin America, you become quickly impressed that the World Bank proposal for reform seems like a word process document that is a boilerplate. The names and individual characteristics vary somewhat by country, but it's basically the same overall model. This is the evaluation by the Inter-American Development Bank personnel of the Colombia system in health affairs, a very vague type of evaluation that includes such comments as the results of providing health insurance for all in a middle-income country by insuring more than 80% of the population. So this is one of the kind of funny contradictions of this type of evaluation. Now, in that report, they acknowledge various weaknesses of the Colombia plan. No randomized trials, so the analysis had to rely on retrospective, already available household survey data. It's only a cross-sectional analysis. And they could not determine anything about causality in the impact of health insurance on health outcomes. And this is the book that was published by Brookings and the Inter-American Development Bank several years ago, a very positive evaluation of the Colombia reform. However, I just wanted to mention, this is part of the ideology that underlies the report. these are a couple of quotes. Achieving, excuse me, this is a pointer that we got for our kitties, and it doesn't seem to be working today. Back up. Achieving universal coverage faces several hurdles, not only because of financial considerations in the economy as a whole, but also because of the existence, and this is key, of safety net providers that act as substitutes for insurance and provide incentives to ride the system for free. So it's basically conveying the ideology that ipso facto, safety net providers are the problem because they substitute for private insurance. The resistance of public hospitals to forgoing supply-side subsidies cannot be underestimated, owing to the political visibility of hospitals and the challenges posed by decisions made in the past. So a very strong set of assumptions against the public sector to start with. Now, essentially every other evaluation not connected to the international financial institutions has been much more critical. And this is one of several that came out in Lancet. Columbia has some hurdles. Even though universal coverage seems beneficial, it has raised substantial criticisms. And these are just some of them. So in Colombia, there's actually been a system of lawsuits that's been established in order to deal with barriers to access under the national reform, and these are called tutelas. And this, in 1 year, there were about 150,000 of them, and these have increased since. These are the ability of people to sue the government when they can't get adequate access. And similar developments are happening throughout Latin America in the countries where this type of reform has been put in. Costs are outstripping public funds available, inadequate citizen consultation, and improving programs. This was in BMC Health Services Research. Independent assessments have been much more critical, basically showing barriers to access that result from segmented insurance design, as Jonathan was referring to, with insufficient services, insurance managed care and purchasing mechanisms, provider network structural and organizational limitations, poor living conditions, and this refers to the fact that it doesn't address inequality and underlying social determinants. And the conclusion, insurers and providers' values were based on economic profit permeate all factors. And just two other brief studies that came out very recently. This is a qualitative study in Medellin based on in-depth interviews. They're reaching their conclusion, as our study found, the situation in Colombia is totally different from the theory proffered by supporters of neoliberal reform. This came out in the International Journal of Health Services, and one that just came out in the Medical Anthropology Quarterly, which is based on fieldwork in Colombia, focused on the legal appeals, and basically there was a new law put in 2011 that limited people's ability to sue. This last piece of legislation approved in 2011 presents powerful techniques of language to protect the system's market structure by controlling the expansion of the right to health care through the judiciary. And I wanted to just emphasize the role of language because this is actually very similar to the role of symbolic politics that applies to Obamacare. Tropes such as the country's limited resources and, quote, protecting the system's finances to guarantee the rights of the most vulnerable sectors of society can be utilized to create a new social contract around a limited right to health care. So then, Obamacare. And I wanted to just touch on a couple of key points here. The first is that early in his career, Obama actually supported single payer as a legislator in Illinois. But during the initial presidential campaign, he actually received three times more contributions from the insurance industry than his Republican counterpart, John McCain. It's a mandate. Basically, everyone is required to pay, and there are various penalties that are supposed to go into effect, not implemented or even close to being implemented yet. I just was wondering if anyone can recognize this key person.
Liz Fowler.
All right. So who is Liz Fowler? Whoop.
wrote Obamacare. She's from an insurance company. She was an aide to Max Caucus, correct?
Okay. So a key person, now, Ida Hellinger have been trying to get an interview with Liz Fowler for about 6 months now. It's extremely difficult to track down because she is a key person to kind of understand the actual links between the World Bank, Inter-American Development Fund, International Monetary Fund, and how this neoliberal reform originally was developed. She was, as has been mentioned, chief counsel of the Senate Finance Committee in 2001. She actually designed Medicare Part D, benefiting the pharmaceutical industry, then went to WellPoint, now probably the biggest private insurer, director of lobbying activities, then became chief counsel for Max Baucus, developed a white paper that became the basis for Obamacare. Then joined HHS, basically to be in charge of the rollout of Obamacare, and then left it through the revolving door to become director of global health policy that is responsible for lobbying operations for Johnson & Johnson, the pharmaceutical industry, where she works now, although it's difficult to find. So basically what happens then is that the ACA is intended. And that's the important point. It's not that it's a misjudgment or a misdesign or badly designed and its components will not work out. It is intentionally designed to achieve certain outcomes, namely preservation and strengthening of the private insurance industry, and I'll get back to that in a few minutes, and increase public payments to the industry for the care of the uninsured and underinsured people through major public trust funds, namely Medicare and Medicaid. It's the same overall structure as that proposed by the Clintons in the early 90s. These are just a couple of slides from the PNHP slideshow that shows under the best conditions, then the numbers of uninsured will remain about half as what they are at the beginning. And and of course, the underinsured actually will increase under Obamacare. Now, this is a troubling slide that has gotten insufficient attention, in my opinion. This was from a projection that came out in Annals of Family Medicine in 2012 of how the average income per family in the United States will gradually meet the increase in premiums and out-of-pocket expenses sometime after 2020, if they increase at the current rate. And you can see how these are rapidly increasing currently and will continue to increase under the best case scenario of Obamacare, so that if things don't change, and they predictably will collapse, but if they didn't change, this is where the curves would meet. So Obamacare follows the neoliberal pattern favored by the international financial institutions. It aims to enhance access, and this is the key point, by corporations to public sector health and social security and Medicare trust funds. And this is the main growth area, that is the use of public sector tax-generated funds. An ideology favoring for-profit corporations in the marketplaces justifies these reforms through unproven, as Jonathan was pointing out and showing evidence for, claims about the efficiency of the private sector, enhanced quality of care under principles of competition and business management, principles that have never been shown to be adequate and accurate in the health sector. It deals with healthcare ultimately as a commodity to be bought and sold in a marketplace rather than as a fundamental human right. Now, just a few comments about single payer, not to go into depth about this, but it basically would simplify things, as Jonathan pointed out, by extending a program like Medicare to the entire population. And in the interest of time, I won't go through the details. One of the key points about single payer is that it would socialize the payment structure into one system for everybody. But it would not socialize the delivery system. It would remain pluralistic. There'd be private practices, public and private hospitals, community health centers, etc. There's no socialized medicine, quote unquote, in the sense of a socialized infrastructure or practice. So that's an important characteristic to recognize about single payer, for better or worse. And I'll get back to that in a couple minutes. This, if you haven't, I know that many of you have been active in PNHP, but this is just some of the legislation and the contact information and co-sponsorship, which varies but is in the upper, close to 100 co-sponsors in Congress. And this is the website. Now, what a single payer would do would basically be to achieve universal access by drastically reducing administrative waste, which currently comprises about 25% of all health expenditures. There'd be no co-payments, deductibles, or other expenses at the point of service. The average family and the average business would pay the same or less than previously. And national polls have consistently shown that a majority or plurality, depending on the poll, of people in the U.S. have favored the single payer approach or something very similar to it. This is the classic slide from the PNHP slideshow that shows the growth of administrators versus the growth of physicians over time. And that's what the proposal would aim to deal with. And this is the slide that shows that even under the current situation, we spend more public funding for healthcare than any of the countries with national health programs. And this is the comparison of administrative costs per capita in the U.S. and Canada. This is one of about a dozen projections of how single payer would work at the state level. This was in California, basically working out to be slightly cost saving by eliminating these huge sources of administrative waste. Now, I want to just raise a couple of qualms about single payer at this particular point of history, because I actually believe that we need to do some additional conceptual work to clarify how a number of structural characteristics in the United States and actually globally have changed since the initial PNHP proposal. Now, I'm a co-signature of both the original and the current PNHP proposal, so I'm not saying this critically, but rather from the standpoint of a kind of constructive perspective. First of all, the social class position of health providers, both doctors and other mid-level professionals, etc., needs much closer analysis than it's received so far. In the 1980s, when we developed the original proposal, the situation actually was that a majority of practitioners who are in private or small group practices. And that's changed drastically so that the overwhelming majority of physicians are or will be employed by organizations. There's been a widely recognized loss of control over the means of production and conditions of practice. And so I want to just throw out for thought the concept of the aristocracy of labor, which is a classic Marxist position, which basically argues that there's a mystified position of very highly paid workers. And so people like me and many of us working for employers are basically workers. We've lost control over the conditions of practice for the most part, and yet that is mystified by relatively high salaries. Now, Samir Amin actually refers to this process as a generalized proletarianization. And this captures what the Occupy movement referred to as the 99% and the 1%. So how will this changing class structure impact the transition to a national health program? A question to be considered. A second is the oligopolistic nature of the current for-profit delivery system and whether the insurance industry really is an insurance industry anymore. It can be argued that what we have is not an insurance industry, but a financialization sector where the key payments coming as prepayments, for instance, in capitations from Medicaid, from Medicare, from private insurers to some extent, et cetera, basically come in to a financial elite that then invest. It's not used for prevention anymore, as it was in the pre-for-profit situation. And then through financial instruments, that becomes the main way by which capital is accumulated in the so-called insurance industry. And there's a tremendous overlap between the leadership of the insurance industry and the rest of the financial sector. So much greater attention to these changes in how the insurance industry actually functions now relative to financialization, which is the main way that capital is accumulated now, as opposed to the productive economy. And also, I would argue that it's important to rethink the distinction that we thought about in 1986 at the retreat in New Hampshire, where the single-payer proposal was cooked up initially. We actually debated this extensively, the National Health Service versus National Health Insurance model, and reached a conclusion that we ought to put forward a doctor-friendly proposal, but without a class analysis. Why have we not had more progress in the United States? Well, for a number of reasons. One is false consciousness. For example, allowing claims on the basis of symbolic politics, as Murray Edelman, the great political scientist in Wisconsin, argued, that the major U.S. public policies consistently, in fact, have been the opposite from the political symbolism by which they're promoted. And we see this over and again in regard to health policy. So letting ourselves be fooled through the media. Also repression, and I won't go into that, but this has been a tremendous part of U.S. history. Corporate financing of the political process by the less than 1%, essentially. The lack of a labor party or even a social democratic party in the United States. And mostly not claiming our own agency to affect the process. So the neoliberal model comes home to roost if we let it. So I also have a reference to to Winston Churchill. I won't repeat that, but I'm coupling this with the reference to Samir Amin. Quote, a rapidly growing proportion of workers are no more than sellers of their labor power to capital, whether directly when they are company employees or indirectly when they are reduced to the status of subcontractors, a reality that should not be obscured by the apparent autonomy conferred on them by their legal status. So I'm putting this at the end just to have it be more entering our consciousness as something to consider as we move forward in trying to make strategy during this critical period of history. Thank you very much. Thank you.